This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode number 25 of the Beersmith Podcast. Got a real treat for you today. Jamil Zainashev from Heretic Brewing is coming on the show. I wanted to mention our discussion forum. If you haven't been to it, the beersmith.com discussion forum at beersmith.com/forum has over 17,000 people talking about home brewing and beer. So I urge you to join in the discussion there. The sponsor for this week's show is More Beer at beersmith.com/morebeer. More Beer is not just a sponsor of the show. It's actually a place that I order from quite frequently. They have equipment, they have ingredients, they have kits, they have a huge selection, a massive inventory, great prices, and they'll ship those things right to your door. So I urge you to go right now to beersmith.com/morebeer. When you place an order through one of the links on that site, you're not only supporting the Beersmith sites and all the things that we do, but you're also letting them know how much you appreciate them and their sponsorship of this podcast. And now, this week's interview. Today on the show, my guest is Jamil Zainashev from Heretic Brewing at hereticbrewing.com. He's also the two-time Ninkasi Award winner, 2004-2007, co-author of two books, Brewing Classic Styles and Yeast, A Practical Guide to Fermentation with Chris White. He's also a style profile columnist for BYO Magazine, co-host of the BN show Brew Strong with John Palmer, and it's great to have him on the show. Jamil, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brad.
Well, I invited you to come in and talk about your latest project, which, of course, is going pro with Heretic Brewing. And you're extremely well known in the home brewing community. Obviously, you've been very active for many, many years. But you recently made a leap from software engineering into the dream job of pro brewer. What drove the change to founding Heretic Brewing?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it dream job. I know a lot of people that, you know, brew for a hobby consider brewing a dream job. I think, you know, dream job would be more like the job Bill Gates has right now, or maybe Warren Buffett or one of those guys. That seems like a dream job to me. Just seems like a lot of work. My transition from software to pro brewing, a lot of people think, oh, you know, you decide to open this brewery and you quit your software job. It's like, no, actually, I quit my software job because I couldn't stand the person I was working for anymore. And I was just writing books, working on magazine articles, doing the shows for the Brewing Network, doing appearances, things like that. And that was fine, but, you know, that pays like minimum wage. And I figured, I needed to find something a little bit better. And then the opportunity came to open the brewery, and so now I get paid minimum wage to run a brewery.
But you're pursuing your passion, right?
Yeah, I guess. You know, I was pursuing my passion doing the books and the shows and stuff. I love working with the homebrew community and craft brewers, and that for me was fantastic. Plus, I got to brew what I wanted when I wanted. Didn't have to worry about meeting any sort of production schedule. I just brewed the beer I wanted to make and drink. And I'm still kind of doing that at Heretic, but there's much more attention to, you know, when you're brewing. You got to keep those tanks full all the time. Mm-hmm. You can't let a fermenter sit without beer in it. It's a huge waste of resources.
So it's a whole different ball game then, huh?
Yeah, it's, you know, you need to maximize the amount of beer that's coming out of all the equipment that you've paid tens of thousands of dollars for.
So how long were you developing the idea behind Heretic Brewing before you made the leap?
Really, not long at all. It just, I had always said I wouldn't do a brewery, and it just happened. I went to a friend's brewery that he was opening, and he had been working on it for years, and I just stopped in to see him, and I realized he had such a huge space and such a large brew plant that I thought, there's no way he's going to use all this volume, this production capacity, at least right away. It'll be several years before he needs it all. gee, maybe he'll lease me half of that. And then, you know, I could start a brewery and it'll help him. It'll help us. And that's what happened. And once he said yes, that took like a week. And then I formed a C Corp and got the website and just got everything rolling.
So, I mean, how long was that from, say, start to your first batch, if I recall, was in June? How long did that overall period take?
Well, yeah. So, you know, the corporation was formed in, I think, October 10th. And the first batch was, we brewed it on May 20th and had it ready for consumption in June. So, yeah, that's...
So, I mean, really not that long. That's seven months.
And really, the delay on that was getting federal approval, because we're doing an alternating proprietorship where I'm leasing a portion of the building space. I have my own fermenters, but I use their brew system to fill my fermenters. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that, you need all the same licenses that a standalone brewery needs, you know, without the alternating proprietorship. And then you need other stuff on top of it. So the host brewery, they needed to be fully licensed first, and they hadn't gotten their license yet. We need to be fully licensed, and then you need the alternating proprietorship agreements. So that was slowing us down, and some facility work that needed to be done and various things like that. I think otherwise we could have been going, you know, much quicker.
Yeah. It's still relatively quick though. I mean, you're talking 6-7 months to go from idea all the way through. Pretty impressive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, it was nice and quick. That's one of the, I think, the great advantages of doing something like an alternating proprietorship. You still get to run your own independent brewery, do all your own stuff, but you're, you know, leasing an existing brewery space from somebody to use.
So, so where'd you come up with the name Heretic Brewing? Where'd that come from?
Well, you know, we wanted something a little edgy. And something that kind of described the passion that we have for brewing. And I kept looking through names and doing this synonym search for, you know, words that would work. And you'd be shocked, you know, so many names that you come up with, they're all taken already.
Yeah.
You can't find, you know, a name that isn't already somebody using. And when I came across Heretic, I thought, wow, actually that's perfect. And I thought, yeah, that's, I guarantee you there's already a brewery named Heretic. Nope, absolutely not. And I don't know if it's, people worry about a religious, you know, connotation or something like that. You know, for me, you know, being a heretic is, you know, about the beer aspect of it. You know, anyone who doesn't follow along with, you know, a widely held belief is, you know, often, you know, considered a heretic. So in the world where 90%+ of people drink, you know, light, fizzy, low flavor lager, you're a heretic if you drink craft beer. You're a heretic if you homebrew. So, you know, you're truly all the, everybody listening to this show, I guarantee, is a heretic. So I think, you know, we need to take that passion and, you know, help promote craft beer. So if you don't drink ordinary beer, you are a heretic. The funny thing is, I just got an order for 6 pint glasses from 6 pastors on the East Coast that call themselves the Heretics. And they met in school. And they're all very passionate about craft beer, and they're also, they call themselves heretics. So I thought that was kind of cool. I'm hoping for a photo of all of them holding their pint glasses.
We covered Trappist beers in our last episode, actually. And I mean, that's the long history of brewing monks and so on brewing beer.
Right. Yeah. I don't think there's really any conflict between beer and religion. I think they get along quite nicely.
So what were some of your biggest challenges you faced even before you brewed that first batch of beer? What were some of the things that that made it difficult to open your brewery? And
well, really, for us, it was just licensing and, you know, the facility. You know, getting the last bits of the facility, you know, ready to brew, and you know, getting a licensing. And again, if you were to go and do an alternating proprietorship with a brewery that's already up and running, it would be even faster and easier.
So did you, how'd you finance the whole thing? Did you raise it yourself, raise the money yourself?
Yeah, you know, a lot of money, from my savings. And then also, I brought my sister in and I offered it to my family. I said, you know, you're the only ones that, you know, I'll present it to you first. You know, I can get the money other ways, but if you guys are interested, and one of my sisters really wanted to jump in on this. And so that's cool. The entire funding for it.
Fantastic. So right around the May, I guess, you brewed your first batch of Heretic beer, which was a huge milestone. How'd that feel?
It was great. It was a little, you know, I wouldn't say that I was nervous. I was just excited. It was, you know, to see finally, you know, the in operation. And while it was only 7 months, it seemed like it took forever. So just getting that first fermenter full was exciting for us.
So you currently have four beers in production, it looks like. Can you walk us through the four that you're offering right now?
Right now we have the first beer we actually did was called Taffel Bully, and that's a pro-am beer I did with a friend of mine out of Southern California, Matt Staley. He's an excellent brewer, and he always has interesting creative beers, and he always wanted to do a pro-am beer. So I said, hey, you know, when we start up, we can go ahead and do it. The interesting thing was we were going to brew some other beers first, but our first brew day got delayed because of licensing and all that. So it came down to the point where we had to brew his to meet up with his schedule and being able to get these done for the homebrewers conference. So that was actually the first beer that we brewed. And that is a light Belgian, pale Belgian. It's kind of like a table beer, but stronger. So it's about 5%. It's got a Brett finish to it and a very light dry hop with Amarillo and Sriracha. So kind of citrusy, floral, interesting Brett character. We wanted something with a lot of character, but not a lot of alcohol. And that's what Taffel Bully is. The Evil Twin, a lot of people are familiar with my Evil Twin recipe that I came up with years ago and the name Evil Twin. And there's actually a kit at Northern Brewer. They sell Evil Twin. And that interesting thing on that was I did not want to do all the complex malts that go into that recipe. So I was going to simplify it. And I got too busy. So I told our brewer, Chris, I said, hey, you know, why don't you take a shot at it? You know, crystal, roast barley, and pale malt. And let's just play with those and get the right concentration of that and call that good. We wanted the same philosophy as the homebrew Evil Twin, which is all late hopping. So that worked well, but the problem we're having is we have a hot stand in the whirlpool. We whirlpool 20 minutes and then we let it stand for 20 or 30 minutes. And then the transfer time, you know, it ends up being about an hour before it's cooled and in the fermenter. And during that time, even though you add no boil hops. There are no hops in the boil in that beer. We add the hops when we turn the boiler off. And we still get about 65, 70 IBUs out of it.
How do you do that?
Well,
normally you have to boil them, obviously.
Well, that's the thing. Anytime your wort is over, you know, about 170, 175 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to get isomerization of the alpha acids in the hops. So people, you know, don't realize that. That's one of the reasons that things like calculating hop bitterness is very difficult, because you need to take into account the hot stand after the boil. You know, boil time doesn't really tell you everything, you know, and you have to take into account, you know, the amount of yeast and everything before you can figure out what the finished IBUs will be. So, yeah, we get, you know, isomerization. We're adding so much hops at 0 minutes, they all still isomerize to give you 65, 70 IBUs measured. the Evil Cousin we're doing, that is pretty much a double IPA. And it's kind of a joke because of the way they talk about Cousin on the Brewing Network. And we thought we would make a double IPA that was very dank. And instead of all the, you know, there's so many double IPAs out there with all the citrusy character, we thought we'd make them with a different hop character. And so we went dank and we went with Columbus, Apollo, and a tiny bit of Summit. And that gives it just a great bold hop character, but without so much, you know, citrusy, more a little, you know, a little bit of piney. But that has a real light malt character. It actually finishes at about 1.5, 1.4 Plato. So real dry, real light. And that's what I love about great beers like Pliny. It has a dry, light finish, and it helps make the beer so much more drinkable. Over 8% alcohol, but you can drink just pint after pint of that stuff. It's real easy drinking and a great, really hoppy, bitter beer. When I pulled a sample off the tank when it was just done fermenting and sent it in, and came back at 101 IBUs. So I don't think the IBUs drop off very quickly over time.
Right.
But yeah, we actually had it measured at 101 IBUs. So it's a smooth bitterness. And then Miscreant, I'm working on that currently. That is a kind of a soured porter. I wanted to, I've always been fascinated with the story of Alexander Rodenbach and how he went to England to learn to brew. And he learned to brew at a time when porter brewing, the heyday of porter brewing was in full swing in England. And the techniques that he took back, a lot of them were how they brewed porters at that time. And I really love the Rodenbach beers, but what I was curious about is why is there no, you know, darker roast character in there? Is it something that, you know, the flavor wasn't good, or was it more like an expense thing? Maybe, you know, the Black Patent malt at the time was expensive or hard to get there, or whatever. For some reason, they didn't do that. And I became curious, what would a beer be like? I make a great Flanders Red. I thought if I was to take a porter base and do that same process on it, would I end up with like an Oud Bruin, or would it be something else? And it's something else altogether. It's you know, rich and chocolatey, along with the cherry characters and the tartness of the souring and the Brett and the oak and all that. It really is just a great combination. I'm really excited about that. So that's still working its way through the barrels and the aging, and the once the souring gets to the level we want, we'll be releasing that hopefully not too much longer. You know, things like that, they take a good year to make, so we just all have to be patient. And then we've got a couple more beers that we're that we've brewed and we're working on right now, so a lot more to come.
Well, fantastic. Now, you've been designing great beers for a long time. What's sort of the process you go through to sit down and design a new beer?
You know, it depends. I think a lot of times it just comes from inspiration of one kind or another. For Evil Cousin, you know, Chris and I were talking and we thought to ourselves, well, you know, we really can't get a lot of the most sought after hops right now. We've got them contracted for a couple of years out, but we couldn't get any this year. So, you know, even if we wanted to do something like an IPA or a double IPA, it wouldn't be like everybody else's IPA. And we're like, well, that's a good thing. That's why we kind of, you know, came up with that. Other times, you know, you're having a food or you're eating something and you think, gosh, you know, it'd be really cool if you had a beer that had this character. And, you know, so it might be food driven. It might be, you know, based off of something else entirely, maybe music or, you know, changes in the weather. I don't really know. So I think it's just, you know, kind of an openness, a creative, you know, moment that just kind of the inspiration hits you, and that inspiration can come from anywhere. Once you have that inspiration, then it's just a matter of understanding the ingredients and how you might go about you know, pulling together a recipe that fits.
Now, how's it different designing a commercial beer versus one that you're going to brew at home, for example?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it's very similar. The only thing I'd say on commercial is you ask yourself a couple of things. One is, are people going to want to buy this and drink this? You know, whereas you brew at home, it's like, well, who cares? You know, you think to yourself, is that going to be good enough for me to choke down 5 gallons or to, you know, share it with my friends and get rid of 5 gallons? You know, that might be a question you ask yourself, or you might just say, well, I don't care. I'll just throw it away if it's no good. Commercial brewing, you got to ask yourself, you know, do we think this will be commercially viable? And if the answer is no, you may still do it, but you got to kind of know ahead of time how much you're going to brew. It's like when we did a double IPA, we thought, well, yeah, it'll be commercially viable and we're going to sell a lot. So we're going to have to brew this regularly. If we're doing something, you know, odd that we don't think people would enjoy a whole lot, or it'll be limited to a smaller demographic, maybe like a sour beer, like the Miscreant, then, you know, we probably won't brew quite as much. The other thing is you need to ask yourself about the ingredients, because while I can purchase all the ingredients that I could possibly want to use, the problem is in storing those ingredients. I have to keep those ingredients on hand. Once I use them in a beer, I need to have, you know, the next batch of that available in sacks, or, you know, the character malts and things like that. So you tend to ask yourself, well, you know, I have this, you know, 550 love roasted barley or whatever it might be, or chocolate malt. You know, do I really need the 400 love chocolate malt, or can I use, you know, a little bit less of this other one? So you tend to ask yourself things like that, and you tend to tweak recipes to kind of simplify things. It's not that, you know, pro brewers have something again. You know, a lot of times they say, you know, simplify just for flavor. That's true, but a lot of times I think simplification comes just because on a commercial basis, it's a hassle to work with too many ingredients.
Makes sense. Now, I was reading on your blog about the glories of cleaning kegs. You had it on the Heretic Brewing blog. What are some of the less glamorous aspects of going pro?
I'd say distribution, taxes, and you know, all the business related stuff. The brewing part, you know,
kind of fun.
Cleaning kegs. Everybody, you know, that home brews ends up cleaning kegs or bottles or something like that, and everybody's got to haul away the spent grain, and you end up doing all the that kind of work as a home brewer or as a commercial brewer, just on a different scale. And so that stuff doesn't bother me at all. I enjoy doing that. I like the physical work. It's just that you know, you take the hobby, and it's actually very similar to a hobby, but you have all those business aspects that are layered over it, and that's where it becomes true work.
Well, that kind of leads us right into the next question. You know, obviously you're heavily involved in the business end of things as well, and you're right that it's, you know, harder than it looks to slap a label on a beer and sell it to the thirsty hordes, but what are some of the lessons you've learned in business so far in your first year?
Oh, lessons that I knew I would learn. You know, that things aren't going to work out the way you've planned. You know, the numbers are not going to always be what you forecasted. Either they're wildly, you know, more or wildly less, and it can be a positive or a negative. The problem is it becomes very difficult to kind of run your business and plan things when all your numbers are completely different. You don't expect something to happen, and then, you know, it kind of throws you for a loop, and you have to constantly adjust and come back around and figure out how to straighten your path out again.
Browsing your Facebook page, it looks like you've been very active in the festivals to promote Heretic Brewing. What are some of the marketing aspects of the business that you're working?
Well, we actually have held off on festivals. There's a couple that we've done just because friends have asked, and we were able to do it. But generally, we kind of hold off on that sort of thing. There's so much to do and we have so few people that just doing a festival takes away from the ability to produce beer. And right now we have to produce more beer until we get revenue to a certain point. Then we can hire somebody to do festivals. It'd be much easier. I think the main source of our promoting the brand has really been through the homebrew community. Luckily, I have some, pretty good connections with a fair amount of homebrewers. And when the word got out that I was doing the brewery, everybody was very positive and very supportive. And I think they've been telling other people to, you know, that we'll do great things. And you know, that kind of support has been priceless. I don't think that, we'd have any success, or we'd have we'd be fighting the fight that everybody else in the brewing industry is fighting to get yourself noticed and to get yourself into accounts. We started out and we had, people already asking accounts to carry our beer. So all we had to do was call them up and say, yeah, how much do you want? So just having a base like that of passionate beer lovers that are kind of watching our back and helping us out. Oh, it's tremendous. That right there, I don't know how people would go and do that on their own, but if you can, I think engage the homebrew community. A lot of pro brewers think that the homebrew community is very small and really doesn't matter. And I've heard them tell me that a number of times, but I just don't believe that. The homebrew community may be small in the grand scheme of people drinking beer, but they're passionate and everybody who homebrews, or just about everybody homebrews, other people that drink beer and don't homebrew, they look at that person as somebody who really knows beer most of the time. And they go, hey, you really know about beer. What's a new good beer? I want a dark beer or something like that. That homebrewer, that's your, they affect, tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people with their knowledge and their passion about beer. And if you're well connected to those homebrewers and they, respect what you're doing, then you've got, an army of great, knowledgeable people helping you out. So it's just priceless. I think, all commercial brewers should appreciate what homebrewers do for the craft beer community.
Yeah, I was surprised. I think the AHA estimated there's over 1 million homebrewers just here in the United States. So that's a pretty sizable market. And then if you consider also, like you said, they're often influencers in the market or first adopters in the market. They do have a disproportionate influence. So I quit my job last year to pursue Beersmith, and you did the same to pursue Heretic Brewing. Obviously, being an entrepreneur is a real labor of love. Can you speak a little bit about the passion and some of the things you find most rewarding owning your own business?
Well, the thing that I find most rewarding is that it's my call on everything. I love the fact that I'm responsible for the decisions and actions of Heretic. When you work for someone else, you have to kind of go along with what they're doing. And if you don't appreciate what they're doing, you can say something, but a lot of times, especially if you're in a big corporation, that falls on deaf ears. They really don't care, what you think should happen. So I appreciate the opportunity to be, trying to do things what I consider to be the right way. And, I might be wrong. I might fail at it, but trying to be a good member of the community and trying to create something that people love and all that and making those decisions and having that responsibility, I really enjoy.
Well, I can't leave without asking for one or two homebrewing tips for the audience out there. What are some of the things you'd share for an average homebrewer?
And this is something I've said for a long time, is temperature control. That is a game changer that will make such a big difference in the quality of your beer if you can control the temperature of fermentation accurately. Get yourself a fridge and a heating pad and a controller and carefully control fermentation temperatures. And that's really one of the things that separates most homebrewers from most commercial brewers, is every commercial brewer has the ability to control temperature. And, you know, because if you don't, you'll end up wasting valuable resources in money and ingredients. And homebrewers a lot of times will just depend on, oh, it'll ferment. And if you want to make quality beer, temperature control, and that goes with really one of the most important aspects that people don't realize, is yeast growth affects beer flavor. And sometimes you want more growth, sometimes you want less. And how you control that, you know, is the nutrients, the pitching rates, the oxygen, and the temperature. And so that's why temperature is such a big part of it, is controlling that growth determines how well your beer will ferment, but also what kind of flavors you're going to get from fermentation in that beer. So, you know, focus on that. You know, you should already be sanitizing, and you should be doing full wort boils if you can, and then temperature control. That's the biggest thing you can do.
Well, Jamil, is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, I think, you know, hopefully people will take with them that, you know, I want people to be heretics. I really do. Not just for marketing sense, but I really want, the way that I learned a lot of things was I read and I checked the internet, and back then there really wasn't a whole lot of like podcasts or anything, but you know, I listened to people talk, and I took a lot of it in, but I also kind of vetted a lot of the information. Don't, you know, be a heretic. Don't trust everything you read or hear on the internet about brewing. Take it all in, you know, think about what you're doing, think about whether that information is, you know, really true or not, and maybe do some experiments and figure some stuff out for yourself. I love when, you know, homebrewers try and, you know, do some science and really prove whether something's true or not. You know, that whole secondary thing, you know, drove me nuts. After I stopped doing secondaries, my beer improved. I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, why was that? And, but you know, a lot of the information on the internet is based off of what pro brewers do. What pro brewers do is not necessarily what a home brewer should do. The scale is different. The commercial aspect is different. You know, you can throw in other little grains into your batch. You don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about whether somebody's going to buy it. So you can do different things. And, you know, homebrewers where the great creativity can happen. So, you know, get in there and do something different, do something extraordinary, and just don't accept everything that you hear as gospel. You know, go ahead and give it your own spin and see what happens.
Well, thank you, Jamil. I really appreciate you being on the show and sharing a little bit about your new life at Heretic Brewing.
Sure. I appreciate you having me, and I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoy the software too. I'm new to it, fairly recent, and I'm quite impressed with your new version of Beersmith.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And again, that was Jamil Zainashiv from Heretic Brewing at hereticbrewing.com. He's a 2-time Ninkasi Award winner, co-author of Brewing Classic Styles, and Yeast, A Practical Guide to Fermentation. Great to have Jamil on the show. I'd like to thank Jamil for doing that great interview. If you have any feedback for the show, you can go to beersmith.com/blog, look up this particular episode. It's episode number 25, and leave your comments there. I'd like to thank More Beer again for sponsoring. It's beersmith.com/morebeer as the order page if you want to go ahead and order some great equipment or supplies. And finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show. I really appreciate your continuing support for the show. We're coming up on the 1-year anniversary for the show, a significant milestone, and it's all because of your support. Thank you, and have a great brewing week.